This is Spectator Radio, and you're listening to Table Talk with Olivia Potts and Laura Prendergast. Hello, and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we're delighted to be joined by Ian Dell, the broadcaster, political commentator, blogger, publisher, and former Conservative candidate. You've probably heard him as the host on LBC, and he joins us today to talk about what he likes to eat and drink.
Let's dive in at the beginning. Tell us about what food meant to you as a child. You grew up on a farm, that's right, isn't it?
I did. I grew up on a farm near Saffron Walden in Essex in a little village called Ashton. And I always say I think I had the most idyllic childhood because I can't think of anything better than growing up on a farm. And we didn't have all the health and safety things that you have now. I was driving a combine harvester unsupervised at the age of 8. And my father would have the corn trailer with kids on the top from the village. You think he would be put in prison for that now, but it was great. Nobody had an accident. I'm sure somewhere in the country someone was probably killed, but hey. So yeah, it was a wonderful upbringing. Had two fantastic parents, and my mother was the best cook in the world.
And did she cook using produce from the farm?
Or? It wasn't really that kind of farm. It was mainly arable. We had animals, so I suppose, yes, to an extent. And my father loved shooting and all that sort of thing. I did shoot, but I was a terrible shot, and I've become so metropolitanised now that the thought of actually going to shoot a pheasant now horrifies me. It was all fresh food. I mean, there were no ready meals in those days. It was all fresh produce. You would go to the local greengrocer. You would not go buy stuff from a supermarket. It would be all fresh from Gillett's in Saffron Walden. I think that was the name of the greengrocer.
So what would she cook?
Well, I've made a little list in preparation for this. She was the most brilliant cook of cakes and desserts, or puddings as we would always call them. And it's just everything she made was superb. But she never cooked fish. She didn't like fish. So consequently, I don't really eat fish. I've learned to eat salmon, but most fish I find just disgusting. The thought of eating sushi just repels me. And she never drank coffee or tea. I don't drink coffee or tea. So I do blame my mother for a few things.
You've been conditioned.
I have been slightly conditioned. My sisters do drink coffee. I'm not sure they drink tea. But I think you do kind of follow your parents. And I've always been a very unadventurous eater. So I know what I like. And it takes a little bit for me to really try something new that I think might be a little bit yucky. And it wasn't really until I left home, I suppose, that I did sort of venture out. So it's very English cooking, always had a roast on a Sunday and just sort of normal things in between. I mean, the things I remember, I suppose, most were she used to do brilliant sort of suet-based puddings, jam roly-poly, spotted dick, there was a sort of apple thing that she used to steam. I can't remember how she did it. She had to tie it up in a sort of bag and put it in this steamer. And it would come out, it was apple and suet pudding, and then you'd put golden syrup on the top of it. And she also did this thing, which I tell everybody to do. If Yorkshire pudding is my favourite food in the whole world, and I would have it with everything. And we literally did have it with everything. It wasn't just with roast beef, it was with lots of other things as well. But she did this dessert Yorkshire pudding, apple Yorkshire pudding, where you put the batter in a big baking tin, get it all sort of sizzling, and then put sliced apples in it in rows. And then you don't get the sort of high sides when you do that, but it tastes fantastic, and you put golden syrup over the top of that. So is it any wonder I'm a type 2 diabetic? Because I have an incredibly sweet tooth. She used to do the most amazing blackberry and apple crumble, and apple dumplings as well, but done in pastry, and then sort of take the core out and stick sultanas down the middle as well. I remember sort of as I was born in 1962, and in the 1970s, food started to become a little bit exotic, where if you went out to a pub, you could have prawn cocktail. Well, I didn't because I hate prawns.
Of course, No, thank you.
We would have things like an Arctic roll or a Viennetta, which I still think those are the sorts of puddings that I always thought made working class people feel middle class, where they and I thought they were disgusting, actually. A Viennetta to this day I cannot look at. I hate it. And an Arctic roll the same. But we always had meals around tables, which again nowadays I suspect is comparatively rare for obvious reasons. And it was just that time of the day when my dad had been out on the farm all day, would come in. We always used to have lunch, or dinner, as we would call it, at 1 o'clock on the dot every day. And then we would have a tea at 5 o'clock. And that would generally be just bread and jam and cakes.
I mean, it sounds blissful.
It was.
Yeah, and what about at school? I mean, what was school food like?
School food was disgusting. I went to the local primary school, Ashton County Primary School. There were about 100 kids there. And in the initial years, we all used to have to troop over to the local Conservative Club for lunch. And it was brought in from Saffron Walden in these massive metal containers, and it was all slop and disgusting. The only thing I can really remember is semolina. And I mean, I don't know how anyone can eat that. I can eat rice pudding as long as it's got blackcurrant jam in, but semolina was just the invention of the devil as far as I was concerned. And the whole food was horrible. And then just before I left, I think in the 2 years before I left, they built a canteen in the school itself, and it did get a bit better after that. And then when I went to the local comp, Saffron Walden County High, my parents made me take exams to get into private schools in Cambridge, but I refused to go because all my friends were going to the local school. So I thought, well, why aren't I? So I did. And the meals there, frankly, weren't that brilliant. But my godmother was a domestic science teacher, or head of domestic science at the school. So in the end, I just used to take in sandwiches and go and have them with her.
So, you obviously had a very good cooking model in your mother. Did you learn to cook from her, or were you too well catered for?
I did learn to cook from her, particularly cakes, because she was a brilliant cake maker. And she made this sort of fruit cake in an oblong tin and huge amounts of sultanas and currants and cherries. I can't stand these fruit cakes that you get now with the odd sultana. It's like bread and butter pudding. When you buy bread and butter pudding from a supermarket, you have to play hunt the sultana. Well, she used to put loads of them in. So I did learn how to cook from her, but as we may come on to later, I haven't sort of put it into practice very often. But one memory I do have from my childhood is when my grandmother, who lived with us until she died when I was 17, she was a great advocate of porridge. And my mother decided one day, and I would have probably been 9 or 10 then, and my two sisters were 7 and 5, and she decided we were all going to have porridge for breakfast. So she made it, dolloped it out into the bowls, put a bowl in front of my father, and he said, "If you think I'm eating that, you've got another thing coming." So because we then refused to eat it as well. And to this day, I just look at porridge and I just don't understand how people can eat it.
Too similar to semolina.
Yeah, it is, yeah. But yeah, in texture.
And after school, you studied German at university and spent some time working in Germany. I mean, did you get a taste for German food?
I absolutely did, and I love German food. I know it's not very fashionable to say that. My first visit to Germany was when I was 15 on a school exchange, and I'd been to Russia on a school trip before that, and Russian food I just found appalling. It was just horrible. And I went back to Russia a few years ago and it hadn't changed a bit. It was still equally as appalling as it was in the Soviet era. But there was one Russian food which I really did enjoy, and that was Russian ice cream, which, if anyone's ever had Russian ice cream, it is a world apart from any other ice cream you will ever have.
What's it like?
It's the taste, I mean, it's just, I suppose, the same taste as we would have or Italians would have, but there's just something about the texture of it which is different. And I remember we were taken to see Madame Butterfly in Russian in the great hall where the Supreme Soviet used to sit. And we were in the front row. We were all between 13 and 16 years old. I mean, the last thing, frankly, that a 13-year-old wants to do is go and see Madame Butterfly. But in the interval, they served this ice cream with some blackcurrant sauce over it, and it was divine. However, there were unfortunate consequences to this. And I hope you haven't eaten recently.
Or are planning to in the future.
No, indeed, because I remember halfway through the final act, I leaned over to my teacher and said, "I need to go to the loo and I need to go now." And the teacher said, "You can't. We're sort of in the front row. Everyone will see. We'll disturb everyone." I said, "I wouldn't normally ask, but I promise you, you're going to live to regret it if I don't go right now." So off we trotted, which is an unfortunate pun in the circumstances. Oh. And we didn't quite make it. And even today, I'm sure there are some crusty red underpants somewhere in the Kremlin. because I obviously had to leave them there. This had an unfortunate consequence, though, because it turned out that it was either half a dozen or a dozen of us contracted chronic food poisoning, and we'd got something called, I think it's called Giardia lambia, and we were quarantined in the school for 6 months. We couldn't use the same toilet as anybody else. At home, we all had to use a different toilet to the rest of the family. And up until that point, I had been a championship swimmer, and I couldn't put on any weight. I was like really thin. After that, I just had to look at something sweet and I would put on a pound, and it completely ruined my swimming abilities. So those bloody communists ruined my swimming career. Anyway, Germany. We got sidetracked.
Delicious
German food. Not a sentence you hear very often. My first trip, I was a bit sceptical about eating any foreign food because my father would always refer to anything that wasn't English as foreign muck. And I became known as Banana Boy because all I would eat were these wonderful German bananas. Now, obviously, they weren't made in Germany, clearly, but they must import bananas in Germany from somewhere very different to us because they were so much nicer. And even today when I go to Germany, I notice the bananas are so much nicer. And I do love a mashed banana on toast, I have to say. But I did start to get into German food, and particularly the different types of schnitzel. Zigeuner schnitzel, which is translated just means gypsy schnitzel, and it's a normal Wiener schnitzel with a kind of pepper onion based sort of ragu poured over it. Absolutely delicious. And there were very few things in Germany which I didn't acquire a taste for. The bread I found slightly difficult because it's so stodgy and very hard in many ways. But once you sort of get into the German psyche, and also the fact that they eat so often, five times a day, and you think, well, no wonder they're so, or can be so fat, because they were literally, my family that I stayed in my second visit to, this is a spa town in Hessen called Bad Wildungen, they would have breakfast at 8, they would have a sort of second breakfast at 11, they would have a big lunch at 1, they would have coffee and cakes at 4, and then an evening meal at 6.
Sounds like me when I'm working from home.
I found that quite a struggle to really. But again, you have to get into the German psyche. And German cakes are to die for. Frau Niesner was the mother of the family. She used to make this thing called an Eierlikör Torte. And it was effectively eggnog, sort of advocat. And it was kind of a cheesecakey type thing. And then this would be poured on the top. And I don't like alcohol particularly, but this was a very sort of alcoholic cake. And every time I went there, I would say, are you going to make that now? Are you going to make it again? And to this day, I will seek out German or Austrian or Swiss restaurants wherever I am, because that's kind of my food of choice.
Mm. Are there any in London that you like to go to?
The one that favourite restaurant in London is the Delaunay on Aldwych, which has a kind of Germanic menu. It's not sort of full German, but it's about as near as you're going to get. And there are one or two sort of specialist places. They tend to be quite disappointing in a way, but I just love the atmosphere at the Delaunay. And you can go celeb spotting there as well. There's a lot of famous people. I remember the highlight of my life was walking past a table where Jennifer Saunders and Ade Edmondson were eating. And I'd sort of saw them earlier, and I was pointed them out to the person. I was like, "There's Jennifer Saunders over there." And as we walked past the table, I heard Jennifer Saunders say to Ade Edmondson, "That's the bloke off Sky News." That was the pinnacle of my career.
And then, so after your time in Germany and at university and working there, you went through a couple of different careers, and you were in Westminster in the 80s. Now, we've had Fraser Nelson on the podcast before talking about his time working with politicians from a slightly different point of view. How did you find the wining and dining? I mean, you've told us that you're not a big alcohol lover.
No, I think it's because, again, my parents never drank. Mm. If my dad drank, he'd have half a shandy. My mother didn't drink at all. So there was not really... My grandmother might have the odd sherry from time to time, which I thought was, I mean, I did taste that once, thought, how can anyone drink this? And I think similarly about beer. I don't know how anyone can drink beer. The taste is disgusting. So I was never a big drinker. The first time I ever drank was when I was at university in Norwich. And I was out in a nightclub and my best friend said, right, we're going to get you drunk tonight. So I said, well, I don't really like alcohol. I don't know how it came to happen, but I had 11 Pernod and black currants. I do come from Essex, remember? a real tarts drink. I had 11 Pernod and black currants in 2 hours.
I mean, what a baptism of fire to the world of alcohol.
Well, it really was. And I can remember being in the middle of the dance floor with this, shall we say, not very pretty girl who I knew had had designs on me. She was in my one of my classes. And she just, like, stuck her tongue down my throat. So I can't have been that drunk, because I do remember that. And I can remember, in the end, saying to Tim, my friend, I need to go home. And so we started walking out of the club, and there was a queue, and there was the captain of the UEA rugby club at the head of the queue, and I just said, do you come here often? And he got called a cab, and it was a Fiat. I said, I'm not getting an Italian car. And anyway, I got back to the where I was living at the university, and threw up for a long time into the loo. And because it was this blackcurrant and Pernod mixture, it stained the loo for 3 weeks afterwards. So God knows what it was doing to my stomach. I've never had a hangover. But then again, I haven't been drunk that often, because I now don't drink at all.
Well, that would be enough to put you off for life, surely, even if you were into alcohol.
Yeah, the only other time I can remember was in my flat when I lived in Docklands. I had a party and I was throwing up in one loo and my sister was in the next door loo throwing up as well. Family values. But when I was, in about 1999, I was on a radio show with Giles Brandreth. It was just before New Year, and he went around the table and said, what are your New Year's resolutions? And I thought, I can't think of anything, so I just blurted out, I'm going to give up drinking. And I never really drank much anyway, so it wasn't a great hardship. But I had found, and this does go back to your initial question, because this is becoming a bit of a Ronnie Corbett monologue. I had found that, particularly in London, if I went out for lunch with someone and said, no, I don't want to drink, I could see their minds whirring and they think I'm an alcoholic. And then I had to explain, no, I'm not an alcoholic. I just don't really like the taste. And also because my tolerance for alcohol, I mean, two vodkas now anybody. So you just sort of think, well, if you don't really enjoy it, I would much rather have an orange juice than a glass of red wine. So you get to a certain age and you think, well, I don't need to fit in anymore. I don't need to just sort of succumb to peer pressure and have a drink. I'm going to drink what I like.
Yeah. And what do you drink if you're not drinking booze?
Well, part of the reason I'm a type 2 diabetic is because I would drink gallons of Fanta and Lilt. Lilt is my favourite drink.
It is good.
It really is. It's gone out of fashion a bit now. You can't get it everywhere. But that was my choice. But now, because of I've got diabetes, and also last year I was diagnosed with a hiatus hernia, which I'd never heard of before, but apparently it's quite common. It's where your stomach sort of tries to push itself up your esophagus, and it means you cough a lot, which, as a radio presenter, not a good thing. So I had to have an endoscopy where they stick a camera down your throat. And I had thought it might be esophageal cancer. I'm not a hypochondriac, but I lost a huge amount of weight in a very short time, and I had this persistent cough. And you start to think, well, anyway, it's turned out to be this hiatus hernia. So I now have to drink alkaline water. It has a bigger pH value, whatever that is. I don't know what it is. Normal, I didn't realise that water could be acidic, but fizzy water, which is what I would normally drink, is acidic.
Oh.
So it has, normal water has a pH value of 7.5, whereas alkaline water has a value of 8.5.
Right.
So it's all about acid reflux, trying to prevent that.
Yeah.
So last September, I had to go on a kind of vegan-y type diet to get all the acid out of my system. So I had to give up dairy, which wasn't a massive thing, cut down on red meat, essentially go on a Mediterranean type diet, and that seems to have solved it.
And do you have to remain on that now, or are you able to?
Well, I've tried to retain bits of it. And I don't eat as much red meat as I used to, but I think that's actually quite common. I think a lot of people are even subconsciously just cutting down on red meat.
Yeah.
But I'm not a great fan of vegetables, you see. So,
so you're slightly limited.
I mean, I'll eat sort of peppers, peas, carrots. Why are you laughing, Cindy? But I don't like greeny vegetables very much. I don't really eat salad. So, and there is, again, it goes back to this, from being a country boy now to not being a country boy, I would like to eat a lot less meat. I do have slight conscience pangs sometimes, and if I think about it too much, I don't want to eat a particular thing. So, but I don't like enough vegetable-y type things to be able to replace them in that way. And I love doing vegan phone-ins on my radio show, because I do think vegans are so up themselves generally. And it's almost become a religion to some people, and I really hate that about anything. And when it comes to food, don't lecture me about food. I'll make my own decisions, thank you.
And when you're on L, when you're at LBC, what do you eat for lunch? Where do you go and get food?
Well, when I was doing the drive time show, it meant that I couldn't really go out to lunch with people all for dinner with people because it finished at, well, I could do, but after I finished at 7, I just wanted to go home, frankly, because people think talking in front of a microphone for 3 hours, it's so easy. I mean, what can be difficult about it? But they don't actually understand all the mechanics of how radio works. So you're actually thinking about 5 or 6 things at once for 3 hours. Well, you try to do that in any walk of life and that will knacker you.
And there must be a certain amount of adrenaline when you're live.
Yeah, it depends. I don't get nervous anymore about doing it. I did in because I wasn't a trained broadcaster, so I always felt that I was one word away from getting the sack. And I still feel that in some circumstances now. But if you're doing a big interview with the Prime Minister or something, yeah, you do. The adrenaline does flow, but it's you've got the producer talking in your ear, you've got the fader in your right hand in case somebody says something that they shouldn't. You're thinking, well, what do I ask next? I mean, it is quite intense for 3 hours, but it's the best job I've ever had, and I absolutely love it. But in terms of eating, it ruins your life in a way. When I moved back to the evening show in September, I said that I only wanted to do 4 days a week because of my diabetes. I do have to watch eating times, and finishing a show at 10 o'clock at night means you can't really have dinner because I can't eat properly when I get home. So I now, every day, will try and have a proper lunch. And so that's the advantage of moving, but it does mean that it's quite difficult in the evening. So I said I wanted to work 4 days a week because I thought 5 days, and that is just going to be too much. And now working a four-day week, it's transformed my life in a way. Most Fridays, I do Good Morning Britain at 6 o'clock, but I can get home by 8 o'clock, so I still kid myself that I've had the complete day off. And I mean, like last weekend, I drove up to my house in Norfolk on Thursday night and drove back on Monday afternoon. So 3.5 days of completely de-stressing. And as soon as you get back into London, you drive the car into Leicester Square car park and someone tries to back their car into yours. And the stress starts immediately.
It's like you've never been away.
Yeah, exactly.
And you mentioned the DeLorme, but do you like going to restaurants? I mean, did you go to restaurants when you were younger? Is it something you enjoy?
When we were growing up, I can't actually remember ever going out for a meal as a family. It just wasn't, and this was mid-1970s, it's just not what people did. People didn't even go to pubs to eat in those days. Pubs were for drinking, and that was it. So it was only really when I went to university that I started to go to restaurants. There's one in Norwich, a pizza restaurant called Pizza 1, Pancakes 2 in Tombland, which I used to live there. But I didn't like cooked cheese, so I'd always ask for pizza without cheese. Can you believe that now? And there were some fantastic restaurants in Norwich. And Norfolk actually has now become quite a sort of gastric sort of centre. There was a fantastic restaurant in Cromer when I was a parliamentary candidate there called Jacques, which is sadly no longer there. And if I find a good restaurant, I will be a very loyal customer of that restaurant, and I will promote it as well. I mean, I became Jacques' biggest promoter. No wonder it went bankrupt, I suppose. There was also a wonderful restaurant in Elizabeth Street in Victoria. I used to work around the corner in Buckingham Palace Road called Cibour, and then it became Oliver. I don't know what it is now, but again, I'd go there all the time. And the DeLorme, as I say, I really like. I've recently joined a little club. I was going to join the Groucho Club because I've got this. I do CNN 3 lunchtimes a week, and then I've got like 4 hours with nothing to do. So I thought, well, if I join a club, I can go and work or have a snooze or whatever. So I tried to join the Groucho, but their membership system, it took 3 months before they even got back to me. And I thought, well, if you're going to have that attitude, you can sod off. So I joined a little club near Charing Cross called Two Bridges. And I sat down, I went for a little tour. A friend of mine is a member there. And it's a strange place in many ways. I sat down with a membership woman and I said, well, what's the system? Do you have to have like meetings to approve me? She says, no, dear. We sit down, we have a conversation, and I decide if you're a wanker. So I thought, well, this is my kind of place. So I joined that in October, November last year. And the food there is outstanding. It's not particularly cheap, I would say, but it is one of the best. Every time I go there, I have a brilliant meal. And there aren't many places you can say that. And it's in it's a bit like the Spectator house. It's sort of a townhouse, but quite thin. And they told me that the cast of Downton Abbey have their reunions. So it's a very sort of actory, louche kind of place. And the staircase, you couldn't get two people walking up it together. And they say they have to push Dame Maggie Smith up the staircase when she comes for the reunion. But the best meal I've ever had was at a restaurant in Paris, which I looked it up before I came in because I couldn't remember the name of it. It's called, my French isn't very good, but Itinéraire, itineraries, I suppose, in the Rue de Pontoise. And I was, the only reason I was there was because I had to go meet Valerie Trierweiler, who was the mistress of President Hollande, if you remember. And she wrote a book, and I was publishing the book. So I went to meet her and her agent, and they took me to this restaurant. And ever since I was a child, going into a restaurant has filled me with fear, because there's normally only one thing on the menu that I will like. And I'm always relieved when I see something that I will like, because I don't, I'm just sort of, I suppose if I'm going to spend money on a meal, I want to enjoy it. So I therefore tend not to try a lot of new things unless somebody else recommends it. So we went into this restaurant and I sat down and I couldn't really understand the menu. And they said, it's very simple. It's called a surprise menu, like my idea of hell. And it was eight courses.
Eight courses of surprise?
Eight courses of surprise.
Wow.
And I thought, this is going to be one of the worst evenings of my life, because there are some things that I just cannot eat, prawns being one, sort of fishy things generally I just don't like. Anyway, every single course came out, and every single course was amazing.
What kind of thing were you eating?
I can't remember now. But I just remember walking out the restaurant and thinking, I will never have a meal better than that. And it was a very small restaurant. There were only, I think, five or six tables. And it was very, very French. And it was the most amazing meal I've ever had.
Hmm. When you cook, what do you like to cook?
Well, I haven't cooked for 23 years.
At all?
Well, with probably a couple of exceptions. I can cook. And when I lived on my own, I was perfectly happy cooking for myself. And then I met my partner in 1995. And to cut a long story short, the only reason we met was because I owned an Audi Cabriolet that had previously been owned by Princess Diana. And my partner's a complete car nut. And so the guy that introduced us said, oh, he'd really like to see your car. I said, why don't you come up and see my car sometime? And unfortunately, I sold that car a year too early, if you get my drift. So I invited him around for a meal, and his memory of this evening, which I'm not sure corresponds wholly to mine, was that he arrived to find the door open with me sitting there in my tracky bottoms, and I cooked a Marks and Spencer ready meal on mismatching crockery and cutlery. And it went downhill from there, really. And so I remember I also cooked a Mexican casserole. I do love Mexican food. Chicken fajitas is one of my favourite food. But I cooked a Mexican casserole, which is effectively a normal British stew with a Mexican OXO cube put in, which I'm sure that's what you do all the time.
That's exactly how I cook, yeah. Correct.
And after that experience, he decided that I was not going to cook ever again, and I never have. I did cook. I went on my own to a house in Norfolk one weekend and invited a friend around, and I did cook a sort of steak meal for him. And I took great delight in photographing it and sending it to my partner saying, see, I can do it. But I didn't put it on Facebook because I don't really like people who put food on Facebook and Instagram.
So don't look at me like that. I rarely do that. Just once or twice a day. Yeah. So does your partner cook or are you reliant on takeaways?
Yeah, he's a really good cook. I think underestimates his own cooking abilities, actually, but he's a really, really brilliant cook. So I'm well catered for in that regard.
And just finally, I mean, it's Valentine's Day when we're recording. I mean, will you be having a special dinner this evening?
No, because I won't be getting home until about 11 o'clock. So I should probably have my usual packet of Brannigan's ham and pickle crisps, which I buy in boxes of 36 from eBay.
That is one of the smartest things that's been said on this podcast.
Is it?
So far. Yes, 100%.
Well, I'm glad.
I'm going home to do the same thing.
I'm glad I've delivered on something. I'm afraid I'm addicted to crisps, and it's really one of my big vices. I have a whole cupboard full of different varieties. Let me give you another recommendation. Yeah. McCoy's chicken crisps.
I don't think I've had them. I have had them.
Unfortunately, you can only get those in multi-packs with other flavours, but there's like
can
two...
Can you get them on eBay as well, or is it?
I haven't tried on eBay. You can get them in Sainsbury's.
I bet you can, because my personal eBay favourite is a single... You can get whichever is your favourite quality street.
Oh, really?
In multiples.
Really?
So for every Christmas, my sister gets me the pink country fudges in multiples of like 85, and they last me the whole year. So I would imagine that McCoy's chicken crisps, there's someone out there who's thought, there's money to be made.
I think that's
here.
A very unimaginative choice, the pink
country fudge.
No.
Everyone says they don't
strawberry
like them.
Strawberry and
what would
orange,
you go for? I'd
definitely.
Go for the penny.
See, no one eats the little fudges, so that's how I used to squirrel them away every Christmas, and then one year my sister said, this is ridiculous.
What do you think, sorry, the interviewer turning around now, what do you think is the greatest food invention ever?
The microplane.
The what?
The microplane, which is, it's a particular type of grater that you can use for like,
no, I
mean
a food.
Oh, sorry, I thought you said food. No. I thought when you said food invention, I think you had like technology. No, food, well, and I can't say Quality Street Country Fudges now, because that's boring.
And you would be lying.
Oh, my favourite food stuff would be really good bread, but I'm not, that's so old, does it even count as an invention? But like really, really good sourdough with really good butter. That partnership, you don't need anything
else. A packet of crisps, I think, is a pretty good good invention.
I would say mint Magnum. Well, I was reading something the other day about apparently there's going to be a shortage of Magnums after Brexit, and I thought, that's it, I'm becoming a Remainer. If I can't get my mint Magnum supply...
Was that not on the side of the bus?
Oh, clearly
that
not.
That would convince you to back the other side.
Exactly. That Project Fear has now worked on me. Or mince pies.
I was reading something the other day that was talking about what you should stock up on for Brexit, and I was sitting there with, sucked into it, as I usually am. I was sitting there with my avocado basket, adding, you know, olive oil and jam,
so
sugar.
So middle class.
I know. And adding all these different things, and then I got to the end
of
the
article. You'd never guess it was a Spectator podcast, would you?
I got to the end of the article, and they said, I mean, of course, there'll also be a shortage of petrol, so you're going to need a horse. And I thought, this has gone too far. You can't get a horse from Ocado. I'm out. I'm not stockpiling anymore. I'm just going to take it as it comes.
Ian, are you stockpiling anything?
Mince pies.
Mince pies.
Yeah, because I love mince pies. My cousin and I, when I was about 15, we had a mince pie eating competition at Christmas. My mother used to make these amazing puff pastry mince pies. And I ate 36. And again, no wonder I'm a type 2 diabetic.
Ian, thank you so much for joining us today on Table Talk. Ian's book, The Honourable Ladies, Volume 1, is available for purchase now, and Volume 2 is forthcoming. In this book, there is a profile of every woman MP from 1918 to 1996, with female contributors from Mary Beard to Caroline Lucas, Ruth Davidson to Yvette Cooper, Margaret Beckett and Anne Widdecombe. If Ian's descriptions of his mother's steamed puddings have whetted your appetites, you can find a recipe for our steamed pudding in this week's Spectator Life online vintage chef column, a marmalade steamed pudding.
Just go to spectatorlife.com/food. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes of this podcast, just go to spectator.co.uk/tabletalk. Thanks for listening.